I hear the sound of distant drums far away, far away.
Hello and welcome to the KFC bucket that is the Libero podcast. I'm your disappointing coleslaw, Richard Mead, and with me is the tasty chicken skin that is Chris Belmore, the lukewarm flat Pepsi that is Andrew Lane, and the bottom of the bucket grease that is Matt Pritchard have both been binned as we are sober tonight. And thank you for joining us for another finger-licking good podcast, Chris. How are you doing?
Well, not as finger-licking good after watching quite a depressing England game. I feel like maybe I need some pity food to cheer me up, so maybe I'll be digging that greasy bucket out of the bin and just chowing down.
References to greasy buckets have gone up 200% already, but I mean it's worthy of mention that we've already used the word lukewarm. Not much more than a tepid display from England tonight.
No, I resolved to watch it because obviously I knew we were doing the pod tonight.
Asterisk sigh, isn't it? It's one of those. Yeah, there wasn't much to be inspired about.
Well, I'll tell you what, I can inject a bit of enthusiasm, even if it's not necessarily positive. Fuck Daniel Sturridge.
That's a strong intro. Go.
I hate him. He's such a waste of space. Like, I don't know why he started the game. Klopp has realised this, and he's been politely phasing him out of the team and buying players who have many of the assets that he has, maybe not as prolific goal scorers, but work much harder for the team. I just get so frustrated when I watch him because he just doesn't play for the team at all. He shoots from every position that he happens to receive the ball in. His runs are very, very selfish. Like, he doesn't make a run to open up space for other people. It's always self-serving, which is not particularly useful from a centre-forward, particularly if your wingers are going to stay wide and Dele Alli's therefore got not much room opening up for him to play off if there's defensive midfielders, which there were. Also, there's a strange phenomenon. Stop me if you want.
This is fun. I'm enjoying this. Yeah.
There's a strange phenomenon. Like, other players stop making runs because it's like, oh, the last 15 times we tried this, you just didn't bother to even look for the pass and just blasted it.
Yeah,
straight
there's no
over
incentive.
The
there's no incentive for players to make runs if you've got one centre forward, which is essentially what England were playing with tonight, and you know that. The manager's chosen that to be Daniel Sturridge, but whoever that is, if that one centre forward is not breaking his neck to make runs to give you space and you're an attacking midfielder or you're cutting in from the wing, not that we did at all tonight, but you're going to be disincentivised to go, well, why am I going to do that for the 98th time today if for the 98th time today my centre forward is going to make a run that is purely self-serving, that's going to get him in a position where I can't pass it to him, or he's going to shoot when he's not in a position to shoot. And it gives your players less confidence. It doesn't make you look like a team.
You look at his absolute best season, and his best season was playing with the total opposite of what we've just described, who always works hard for the team. And don't get me wrong, even way more prolific than Sturridge. Obviously, we're talking about Suarez.
Talking about one of the best strikers in the world, which is clearly creative strikers of the world as well.
But he's so, so hardworking, and it's pretty obvious to say, but I'm a firm believer that that's why Sturridge did as brilliantly as he did. It's like there's a class of players that if you can kind of get yourself, you know, playing in around them and be in their teams, your kind of statistics and your numbers and your performances go up just by being on the pitch at the same time as them almost. And it's not necessarily a huge amount to do with you. He just hasn't looked the same for a couple of years now. I don't know why he was considered. Well, you know,
I mean, the guy's obviously had his injury problems, you know, and you know, there's a lot of people that are big fans of Daniel Sturridge, and there's a lot of people that look at his sort of career long stats and, you know, his goals per games and his shot ratio and the people that love to dive into that. And I know generally you're one of the people that love to dive into that. But you look at that on the field performance tonight, and you look at it, you know, going back, you know, a few games now since he came back from injury, and he does feel almost, I mean, it's a poor comparison to make, but he does feel Ravanelli-esque, which in
wow, I was not expecting to hear.
And
the
I'm
word
gonna qualify Ravanelli-esque. That. I'm gonna qualify that in saying that. I remember when Ravanelli joined Middlesbrough, and one of the hilarious quotes that came out of one of the first match of the days, where he scored a hat-trick, I think, on his debut or something ridiculous, is he scored a hat-trick, but what else did he do? Right, now don't get me wrong, he's a striker, he is there to score a hat-trick, he has scored you three goals, what else do you want him to do? But I think the thing that, you know, they were trying to poorly draw the attention to was the fact that he's either going to have a chance and score that chance and, you know, be in the position to do it, or he is going to have no impact on the game.
Yeah.
And I feel like Sturridge is that player, and in this long drawn out analogy will finally come to a conclusion now, where he, like those kind of players, he is going to hang around the goal. He is going to look for himself and he's going to be selfish. And some of the best strikers are selfish, but he's either going to have a massive impact, he's going to get on the end of those crosses, people are going to serve him, or he's going to have no impact at all. And it, too often lately, it's been the latter.
That striker is very useful. I remember watching a game years and years and years ago with Ruud van Nistelrooy, where he did absolutely nothing except score four goals. but they can't really play if there's no one else around who's going to do that dynamism. So if you think of that Borough team, there was, you know, a whole host of players, you know, Juninho and et cetera, a whole host of players around him who were, you know, probably creating space for him, and he had quite a good season with Borough. But
certainly very creative players around him.
With this England team, you've got Walcott on the right, who isn't a winger, not a striker either, doesn't really know, he doesn't seem a particularly intelligent footballer, it's been touted before. Dele Alli, who I absolutely love, but I think you've got to work with him and give him room to do stuff. Rashford, who is okay, I think he's not a brilliant player. Like, he was on loan with us, was it last season or the season before, and couldn't really get in Derby's team. I think, you know, he's a decent player. And then you've got the two midfielders who both kind of sat, and Henderson wasn't really pressing on. So there's just nothing doing. There's no movement. It was all very, very slow and predictable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously the fuck Daniel Sturridge thing is interesting. But I think Daniel Sturridge and the way he plays, you know, has its place in a team that is going to run for him, that is going to use him as, you know, like, this is our core, our central way to get through to the goal. We're going to provide for him. We're going to, you know, set up creative players around him. He is our focus. The same way Borough did with, like, you know, the likes
also,
of
Ravanelli. Also, we're going to have players who are going to push past him and make diagonal runs off him, cut inside, and, you know, and that type of player, and he's proved it before, he can get millions of goals, but this team isn't set up that way, so why is he the person that you want to put in there? I mean, I'd love to see, like, a kind of map of England's possession tonight, because I reckon it would just be a U shape where the ball goes all the way from one wing, Lindgaard, and then comes back, you know, through Rose, and then across to one of the centre backs, or maybe Dyer, who's crossed into the, and then out to the other wing, and then almost all the way back. And it's just like someone's drawing a U shape on the pitch in steady, like, heavier and heavier pencil. I'd imagine that would be the most prominent move of the night. And it's just, you talk about moving the ball from side to side to get behind people and, you know, disrupt their play. None of that happens when you're just moving in that big, massive U shape, because everyone has time to get positioned and shunt across as a unit.
It's fine moving the ball from side to side, but it's about quick movement as well. You know, the disruption in play, the way that you move people out of position, the way that you find space, the very, very basics is about speed, retaining possession, speed, making them chase it. And we just didn't do any of that. Once again, I mean, we drew on this last time, but England look ponderous, they look slow, they're not using some of the skills that we know are in that squad. Henderson can pass the ball, you know, I'm not saying he's an A-grade player, but he can pass the ball. Dele Alli has been phenomenal for the last season and a half, he's been fantastic, we know what he can do, and it's frustrating to see those players handicapped almost, because you know they can play better than this, and you know if the system's set up right they can play better than this. I mean, one of the things that was heartening for me, and I don't mean this as a knock, was Rooney not starting. I thought that was, you know, I thought there was a
Joe Hart pun coming then, but well done for holding off.
Yeah, well, you know, there we go. small mercies. But yeah, I thought Rooney not starting was positive. I thought it was good to see some admission. Something that everybody knows, everybody's watching these games, everyone can see Rooney's been under par since the start of the season, if not well before that. You know, let's give other people a chance. I'm not sure, as we've said, that Sturridge was the person to give that chance to, but at least we've put other players on the field, we've given them a chance, we've tried something out.
I mean, there isn't a particularly obvious choice, I guess, because Vardy hasn't really hit form yet. Rashford, okay, but he's kind of playing out on the left usually at Man United, and this is, you know, an important qualifying game. It might be a bit much to throw that onto he's only just turned 19, I think, hasn't he? So you know, I can kind of see where this decision came from, but still, it's just the picking of that particular front three, and then seemingly the game plan was all about width. But you know, width is not a bad principle, but just staying wide and no interchange between the front three. I think all of those players can probably play in all three positions if they had to across the front three, and Dele Alli certainly can you know, fill in and create space and do those anarchic jobs that he needs to do. But yeah, just didn't seem to happen. I felt quite sorry for Dele Alli because I do absolutely love him, but much to work with.
Yeah, I thought he played well with what little possession he got. I mean, he looked like he was constantly trying to create things. I mean, there was a couple of back heels, there was a couple of things he tried. I mean, they didn't come off more often than not, and certainly they didn't lead to a goal, obviously, but he was trying. You could see, like, and to be fair, even Andros Townsend, who is, for me, the biggest one-trick pony, and that he is going to run down the wing, he's going to cut in on his left, and he is going to shoot or cross. And he did that repeatedly. But he did it to some effect. He did test the keeper. He did put a couple of searching balls into the box, and which was more than was happening in the first half, where we didn't register a shot on target. So, you know, there is stuff in there, but it did feel disjointed. It did feel like this team is not yet a team still. Which,
although I think one of the comments when he did come on was that, oh, you know, he looks like he's got a bit of fizz about him, and you know, that's just means he's running around a lot, and it's like, I kind of want more than just fizz. I want like a cohesive game plan of players who are trying to achieve a thing and go out and do it.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, one of the things that summed up the game for me, or certainly summed up England lately for me, you would have seen, I think it was around the 70th minute, it's certainly around that time, Henderson's no-look pass back to Cahill, which just let in Ilicic. And Joe Hart had to make a good save.
The one in the first half, that was Eric Dier, wasn't it? Not Henderson.
I thought it was Henderson. Was it Eric Dier?
I'm pretty sure it was, but anyway, carry on, the point still stands.
There was a no-look pass, so I'm pretty sure it was Henderson. He looked one way, he tried a cheeky pass, it went back. Ilicic was off quicker than Cahill could react to it, and he was in, and Hart had to make a good save, and we'll get on to Hart's performance. But it kind of, for me, in one moment summed England up. This was England trying to do something a bit creative, but one, not having a game plan and not getting the basics right first. It's great. Oh, I'm going to do a no-look pass back to a defender. Why? Why are you going to do a no-look pass back to a defender? What's that achieving? Nout. And then we let a player in. There's a shot on goal. It's potentially, you know, an opportunity where we could have conceded from. And it was hugely frustrating. There was an air of arrogance to that. And I just feel that's England summed up at the moment. There's an arrogance, and there's, oh, we can try a flick and we can try a trick, but we can't get our basics right. We can't get our tactics right. We can't build a team on a basic set of, we are going to play 4-4-2, we're going to play 3-5-2, we're going to try and hit the middle, you know? We can't get those right.
What do you think Southgate should do here? Because he kind of made a statement, obviously, dropping Rooney straight away.
Yeah.
And you've already hinted that that's something that you like. And he's kind of got these four games, and it's sort of like, I don't want to say it's a win-win situation, but I don't feel like he can really lose, because I feel like he can probably try out a few things and maybe do something a bit crazier, and see what happens. And if it doesn't work out, he can, you know, he can like leave under the guise of, well, look, I was trying a few things, and like I knew that I had these four games, and I was trying to sort of almost lay the foundations for what's coming for the next manager. Yeah. And if it does work out, cool. But I just fear that he's probably going to go back to the kind of the tried and tested and the old guard and the, you know, the way that we're playing at the moment, and that's going to be like a default reaction after this, which you know would be a shame. It's kind of a unique opportunity as a manager of England to come in and kind of have no pressure, because we are going to qualify presumably for the next World Cup, and we're not going to have a problem with that. So
yeah, I mean, I've a couple of things on Southgate. One is fair play to him for having the stones to drop Rooney, you know, especially after, you know, the way the quotes from Sam Allardyce about, you know, it not being his place to tell him where he's going to play, you know, or even basically if he's going to play, to come in and just say, well, I'm making this, and I'm making this for a tactical reason, is a strong statement, and maybe showing some willingness to stand up and be counted. And that's something I respect pretty much out of anybody, but certainly out of football managers. If they're going to make a big call and stand up and say, well, I'm making this decision, and I'm making it for tactical reasons, and, you know, I know that there's a world of shit coming my way from the press about this, and we're going to have to answer all questions, then
and I did like the idea that it was for tactical reasons. Like, I want to play this way against this team, because I feel like that's going to, you know, be the game plan. However it worked out, but the sentiment of, like, not just picking the best players and putting them in and like, okay, we'll use the same players if we're going to play in, like, a 4-4-2 diamond, or if we're going to play, like, a 4-2-3-1, or, you know, actually picking players to fit the system. But I just want a bit more.
Yeah. But, I mean, what you say about Southgate is right. For me, he is, as long as he doesn't sort of concede six in the next game or whatever, he is on a win-win. Because he takes over the national team, one, on a temporary basis. So he's only got a limited amount of time. So he takes it over a very low point after the Allardyce scandal. And where we've failed consistently at previous tournaments and embarrassingly went out of the last one. So if we get poor results, he's not going to be strung up for them. It's not going to be his fault. He's got the opportunity to play with this a bit, and he's standing up and standing in at a time when most people probably wouldn't want to. So yeah, he is on a bit of a win-win, and I hope he does use that opportunity to go, well, let's try this and let's try that. You know, he knows the under 21 team better than pretty much anyone.
Yeah,
he's been managing them. You know, he called up Pickford. You know, he doesn't seem afraid to do that kind of thing.
So you're saying he's our Pep Guardiola? He's going to bring
That it's only a matter of time before you see Connor Wickham starting up front. And we can all be happy about that.
Get Will Hughes in the first team. That's what I'm talking about.
Will Hughes in the first team and a fit Andy Carroll, and finally we have something to hit it fucking to if we're going to keep hitting it in the middle.
Oh god! But, anything but that, please.
What? Come on! Anything but that after what you've just seen, really?
Should we move on?
Okay.
Why don't we have a look at some of the games coming up next weekend? To keep it moving.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, it's an international break this weekend. There's some bigger games coming up the weekend, but there's three I know that we both want to particularly talk about for a variety of reasons. The first one, I've got some interest in this one. It's Palace West Ham.
We both said that one. I think that's really the one to watch this weekend.
There's a lot going on here. More than just it's on the pitch, obviously, but you know, with West Ham's current terrible form starting this season, and Palace seem to be coming into some form and finding some bite after what seems to be Pardew arresting an initial slump, which would be a first. Then there's a real narrative about this that's interesting. I don't know how you see this going. What do you reckon?
Well, Palace are looking much, much better at the moment. It remains to be seen. You know, Pardew famously only operates in half seasons, so we'll see what happens. But I think their pressing is much better this season. I think a few sort of statistics have been floating around how they're one of the most effective pressing teams in the league, actually.
Cool.
And, you know, I really love Jedinak, but I don't think he's a pressing player. I think he's like a monster in the middle of the pitch and a good passer and, you know, a good deep defender, but probably not a presser.
Sort of player that will take a red.
Yeah, if he needs to. And West Ham have, you know, obviously been notably atrocious. 15 conceded in the last five games. And it's not, you know, I think 11 of those were Watford, West Brom and Southampton. And 7 of those 11 were at home. So, you know, it's not... They are
in turmoil.
I don't know. I sort of wrote into the running order a couple of times, how much longer can this go on? They've had the international break. Like, is this the week they turn it around? But then I deleted it.
I mean, it could well be the week that they turn it around. The thing that's baffling for West Ham fans and certainly people familiar with West Ham's style of play last season is they don't seem to have changed that much their style of play. I mean, they are playing poorly, they're defending very poorly, but the players that are on that pitch are by and large the players that were playing well last season. We've mentioned it before, they were conceding a lot last season but getting away with it because they were scoring a lot. They are now not scoring enough. They're scoring regularly in games, they're not scoring enough, they're conceding way too many. You do feel like that they could turn it around. You do feel like Bilic is strong enough. He's got a good personality. He seems to have supported the dressing room. There are undoubtedly quality players there in, you know, obviously Payet, but players that they've brought in as well, and certainly players that did the business from last season. Antonio's been on fantastic form. But you do wonder, you know, if they're on the verge of turning something around. And I certainly hope for West Ham that they will do that. But Palace, they're not a team I'd want to play right now. Like you say, they seem to be hitting their stride. Benteke will have nothing but his confidence boosted from the goals that he scored. I think it was against Gibraltar in the last couple of days, including one after 7 seconds, which is fastest ever
qualifying goal.
Yeah, that's Lowell's if you want to check that one out.
Is it? I haven't seen it, but he bagged a hat-trick in that game, didn't he?
Yeah. So he'll be running high, and there'll be no reason not to start him. It's not like he would have been absolutely knackered after playing Gibraltar. So
yeah, well, I picked Watford last weekend because, you know, that turned out to be quite a cracking 2-2 game. I think this could be similar. I think it could go either way. I could see Palace absolutely whomping West Ham. I could see West Ham getting their shit together defence-wise and then like nicking a goal or two, I could see like a high-scoring draw. So yeah, that's the one I'm going to have my eye on this weekend.
Yeah, there's a lot of unpredictability about that game, and you just feel like the way West Ham are defending, the way Palace play generally, there's goals in it. So look out for that 0-0 draw.
I wonder
Saturday.
If there'll be anyone who's transferring in Christian Benteke and captaining him up for this weekend.
Didn't Andy put him in and then he didn't score any and then he took him out and then he started scoring?
Excellent.
Or am I making that up? So
I don't look that far down the league, mate.
Yeah. Oh, hello. Speaking of Andy, let's move on to Liverpool. Man U, this is a big game. It's always a big game.
Well, it's the first time in a few seasons where I think Liverpool are the massive favourites going into this game, and I really back them to kind of easily beat Man United.
Well, I mean, that's a strong statement. I mean, obviously, Liverpool are at home. It's the Monday night game. And as you say, you do feel like coming into this, they've been playing the better football. They look stronger. They look like a more cohesive unit. Man U have had a string of poor results and certainly don't look anything... Well, they look anything but cohesive right now.
I mean, cohesive, I think, is a really good word. Liverpool look like a team everyone knows what they're doing. I don't want to say well-drilled because Andy was kind of explaining a bit about the ethos last week where it's kind of, if you're not one of the centre-backs or you're not whoever is the holding midfielder in this particular pattern of play, your job is to hit the box, which you know, it doesn't sound that difficult to do, but they definitely look like everyone kind of knows when to move where, how to create space for each other, and yeah, very, very slick.
They look like a Klopp team. You know, it hasn't taken that long, what, a year, and he's come in, obviously he's made some signings, he's certainly made, you know, got rid of a few as well, and they now look like a team, as you say, that knows what they're doing. They know their manager, they know what their manager wants. and they're able to put that together on the field against bigger opposition, certainly against Arsenal, you know, early in the season as well, where that worked perfectly for them.
I'm just looking at that Man United defence, and you know, you've got, I guess, like Darmian or Valencia, who a bit risky, and then the left back situation they haven't really sorted out. And then if you know Blind plays, he's okay. He's definitely not a centre back. I think they're
with that
front four or five of Liverpool's, they can definitely get some joy against Man United. So 2-0, I'll say.
Nice, good strong statement. I like it.
I'm going for it today.
Yeah, you're having it. I like it. We can mock you next week. Or not. A couple of others that caught my eye. One I want to mention is just Man City-Everton. Obviously, Everton were off to a flying start under Koeman, and City at home after, you know, their first game without a win against Celtic recently. I'd just be interested to see how that pans out. I think obviously City will go into it massive favourites, and certainly should be massive favourites. We're hearing Aguero's possibly injured, aren't we? Not that that's proved any issue for them earlier in the season, where Iheanacho's done a fantastic job and probably will continue to do so.
He's not in the same class though.
No, and we see Aguero on that team sheet.
But then, you know, Man City were struggling with a team who was pressing them very high last weekend with Spurs, or the weekend before, sorry, with Spurs. So it'd be interesting to see Everton, not tremendously dissimilar in the way that they play, not as slick, not as good, but not too dissimilar.
And so, I think people will look at that Spurs result and look at the way that Spurs played. Not everybody can immediately alter their game to play like Spurs, but they'll look at that and there will be confidence among the rest of the Premiership that this is a team that can be got at. And certainly we've mentioned it before, Man City do concede. They tend to score a lot, but they do concede. And if you can get at them, you know, as Spurs did perfectly last week, then it shows that they are, you know, able to be got at. And
I think you've got to be fitter than them. I think you've got to be fitter than them to do it, because you've got to press them very, very aggressively. But you've got to keep it up for the entire 90 minutes, because if you do it for 80, they can easily go and put three past you in the
really
remaining 15 minutes. So.
That really is true.
And the other one I had my eye on was Stoke Sunderland. I mean, I don't know why, but bottom two, absolutely atrocious form between them. I think they've probably picked up something like 10 points in the last 10 games between them. Something has to give here.
This is Stoke baffle me, because they should be so much better. They should be so much better. Everything, and much like West Ham, really, that everything about them on paper says this team's going to be a force to be reckoned with, and everything about them on the pitch says, oh, actually, you can forget that.
They don't shoot from good positions. They shoot from atrocious positions. Like if you look at their shot maps and things. Sorry to go slightly geekier, but it's pretty obvious, but you want to shoot from close into the goal and in the centre. That's where the majority of your goals come, and that's, you know, why teams like Arsenal are incredibly frustrating to watch. But it's because they know that four shots from outside the box, you know, is not as effective as like
a
getting that shot inside the penalty area, you know, in between the width of the goal. From just, you know, reading around and looking at kind of what the stats geeks are saying, like, Stoke just shoot from everywhere, and you can kind of understand that when you look at the players that they've got who do like to do that thing, but that they've just got no scoring output at all, and obviously they're conceding a boatload at the moment.
And that's really surprising for me. I mean, with bringing Bonny on, certainly, Bonny is that powerful centre-forward presence that we've seen score regularly in the Premiership from very good positions. And certainly,
although he's not particularly. I don't know if I would class him as a box, like a fox in the box type striker. I think he's a very powerful like runner and holder up of the ball.
But his positioning, you know, certainly at Swansea, it's hard to quantify after, you know, a season and a bit at Man City where he's barely played. But certainly at Swansea, he looked like a player who could command the box, who took up good positions, was available for crosses, and was certainly had the strength to you know, to hold his own and create space.
I've no doubt he can get 15 goals a season or something if he's put in a team that plays, you know, to get that maximum out of him. Definitely. Absolutely. But I don't know. I mean, here's a random prediction for you as I keep throwing them out. I think if Stoke lose, Mark Hughes probably gets sacked. I think they've had a pretty easy run of games of late, actually. I mean, I know they played Man United, but before that, I think they had a pretty easy run of games. I can't remember who they were playing off the top of my head. I was looking at it before the podcast. And they have a pretty easy run of games coming up as well. So this could kind of be the time to get stuck in and try and change it around. I wonder, couldn't be Sam Allardyce, could it? Coming back, I mean, and moving in at Stoke. I like what Guidolin was doing at Swansea, as I've said before. I think they were doing some really good stuff. I think if you got this Stoke team pressing that way, it might take half a season to get it up and running, but I think with the players that they've got, that could be pretty brutal.
If Hughes was to go, and you know, and I'm not pushing him out the door before, you know, we've even had a chance to look at the result, but if Hughes was to go, whoever comes into that team inherits a very nice set of players. It's not like coming in and inheriting Sunderland, which is what Moyes has done, and let's be honest, Sunderland are perpetually in a relegation battle.
And then selling your centre-backs as well.
Selling your centre-backs, yeah, and signing a Victor Anichebe. You know, you're not going to get much joy out of that team as it is, and it does need wholesale improvement. Whereas if you come in at Stoke, you do feel like with the right tactics and the right attitude and harbouring some confidence in the players, you'll be able to bring about results pretty quickly.
So just looking at Stoke's recent results, obviously they had the Man United 1-1, but before that they drew West Brom. They actually lost to Hull at home in the EFL Cup, but we'll skip over that. And before they played Palace, and then obviously they got Sunderland coming up, then they play Hull in the league, then they got Swansea, then West Ham. It's like, this is the time to turn it around if you're going to do it, because you could easily get 10 points from that, and then suddenly you're mid-table and all the pressure's off and it looks a lot more rosy.
I think Stoke will win this, though. I don't think Sunderland have got it, are going to put it together. Stoke know where they sit.
They really bloody need to, though. Let me just read you their fixtures up until the sort of midway through December. So Sunderland at home, Hull away, Swansea at home, West Ham away, Bournemouth at home, Watford away, Burnley at home. That's a hell of a run. And then they've got Arsenal, Southampton, Leicester, Liverpool and Chelsea is the rest of their December, which looks absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
So they've got time to make it happen, but it needs to happen in the next month.
I just don't think there's been much, if anything, about them that said that Sunderland can get a result. I mean, they lost, I mean, what are the last five games? 3-0 to Everton, 1-0 to Spurs. They won against QPR, but then they lost against Palace in that 3-2 game, and they scraped
2-0 up in that as well.
Yeah, and then they got a draw with West Brom, and you know, though again, we're not talking about world beaters. Spurs aside, who have been playing very, very well, and you know, Everton started the season very well, but you know, we're not talking about teams that you know that are Chelsea, that are Man City. We're talking about teams that you would hope that you could get a point from, teams that you'd be trying to at least get a point from. And what have they picked? They one win against QPR, which is a division below, and a draw against West Brom, who are notably one of the weaker teams in the Premiership.
Yeah, this might be Sunderland's season to go, although I think Hull have, you know, everyone knew what was going to happen at Hull. We've stopped saying what the fuck has happened at Hull or is happening at Hull. I think Middlesbrough just do not score enough goals. They're okay defensively, they're reasonably solid defensively.
But they look so good.
But they just don't score at all. I think they're in real, real trouble. Swansea, I think they've had, like I said, I think they've been playing really well. I think they're on the brink of putting something together, and I'd expect to see them move up. Other than that, I think we're probably looking at one other team to go down. So, yeah, Stoke or Sunderland, I guess.
One quick mention before we go to half-time. Obviously, Bob Bradley's come into the Swansea set-up. He's got a very difficult first game away to Arsenal. I think it's good to see an American manager in the league. It'd be nice to see.
He's not an American manager. He's a football manager.
Yeah, I know. Whatever.
But, actually, one of my favourite questions from his press conference was... What have you got that Ryan Giggs hasn't? It's like 30 years of managerial experience.
Yeah, that cracked me up. What is it, this thing about football people, and they should just walk into football jobs because they were decent once? It's like, no, you know, have you done any badges? Have you ever done any man management? Pisses me off. Anyway, but yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how he inherits that squad. Obviously, as we've just alluded to, he's got a lot of experience. And also, you know, the fact that he's American won't be ignored and certainly hasn't been ignored. But it's nice to see that he's got a job in what is one of the biggest leagues in the world. So, and hopefully, you know, with the rise of the MLS over the last couple of seasons, it's just world football and football becoming more of a world game than it ever was. So it's just nice to see him get started.
Yeah, Matt's got a bit of a man crush on him as well, so we'll be watching that with interest, I'm sure, over the next few months.
Cool. This popped to half time. This one's good for me. See you in a bit.
Hutchison. Now Bold. And it's Tony Adams put through by Steve Bold. Would you believe it? That sums it all.
Welcome back to the Lapero podcast. Thanks for joining us for the second half of the show. I like that one.
Did you enjoy that one?
I liked that one.
I thought that one had to go in this week.
Happy birthday, Tony Adams, for last week. Genuinely, probably my favourite ever Arsenal moment.
Yeah, but I think for people of a certain age, you have to go back to Michael Thomas's goal, obviously, but...
People who
are a bit younger, that one is definitely the one.
It just, so much about that was perfect. I mean, I won't go on about it too much, but you know, the fact that the ball was from Bold, the forward run, the handshakes from Wenger, because he knows it was all sewn up at that point.
The left footed volley.
He hit it so hard. If you were a striker, you would be proud of the power and accuracy behind that.
Do you want to know what my absolute favourite bit of it was, which was a bit of a curveball? The person who won the ball back before Steve Bold got hold of it from Don Hutchinson was Bobby Pires. It's just like, what happened in that moment of football? Everything reversed.
I love that.
It's basically the equivalent of like when you're absolutely, you know, smashing someone on FIFA and then you just decide to dribble the ball out from defence with your goalkeeper because you want to humiliate them. And it's like, that's what Arsenal decided to do at that moment.
Worthy of saying also that I give jip to a huge, huge amount of commentators and certainly so-called analysts and things like that who add nothing to the game with their snarks and, oh, aren't we watching a boring game, or you know, it's not a classic kind of stuff, but the commentary for that, just every time I get goosebumps.
Would you believe it?
Yeah, every time I get goosebumps. So fair play on that one. Fair
good
play
old Martin Tyler.
Yeah we're going to take us down a couple of leagues for our lower league libero slot. Do you want to kick off with your Colchester roundup? It's been an interesting... well, I say it's been interesting. It's been a 0-0 style interesting.
I don't really want to kick it off at all, to be honest.
Well, I don't want to either, because it's not good where I sit either, but go for it.
Last week I was saying that they really, really needed to get something against Newport because it's at home, they're bottom of the league, they're absolutely shit. And there's a difficult run of games coming up, but and probably Colchester had the better of the chances, hit the bar, and but just couldn't really get the goal, and actually it petered out into a pretty scrappy, even game, if I'm honest. So Colchester had the better chances, but didn't particularly dominate. Really bad. I think like Newport had lost their last three. I think they'd only picked up 3 points in the last seven games. It's like, guys, you've got to win this.
Yeah.
So really, really crap run. I think they've got Colchester got 2 points from the last 15 on offer. They're down into mid-table now. And as I was alluding to last week, the next run of fixtures is crazy. In the next three games, they play Doncaster and Plymouth away, who are second and first at the moment. So... not expecting much from those two games. So, yeah, all gone a bit off the boil at the moment, unfortunately.
Yeah, not a great turn of results for Colchester, who I, you know, admit I have some affinity for, having spent my misguided university years there. So be nice to see them turn it around soon. There's not much better news coming from MK Dons, who are desperate to retain their worst home form in the Football League status, and did so successfully at the weekend, live on Sky, with a 1-0 loss at home to Port Vale. Port Vale, at the time, had the worst, I'm not sure if they still do, had the worst away record in the league, and that still wasn't enough for the Dons to turn on a home performance with a win, or, you know, even a draw in this case. It was desperately annoying. They looked bright, to be fair, in the first half. A guard went fairly close. I think it was in the opening sort of 3 or 4 minutes, and with a header. And I thought, okay, here we go. There's something to, you know, there's something about them today that maybe they're going to get going. Maybe they're going to turn this on. But, you know, 35th minute winner from Alex Jones. And once again, they had their chances. They, you know, they got into fairly dangerous positions. Ben Reeves almost put a point on the board when he hit the bar late on. But they just couldn't do it. And once again, they just can't do it. And it's so frustrating. I mean, like, if you're a season ticket holder there and you've now gone, what I think is it, 10 games without a win? You know, they got jeered just before the final whistle, and I think at the final whistle. And it's
particularly because, as I'm sure Matt will be telling us next week, they've slipped below their competitors from their former homeland.
Well, I wasn't going to mention that out of respect to my adopted team. But yes, it is fair to say that AFC Wimbledon now sit above them for the first time ever in their history, which is going to be embarrassing for pretty much everybody. but they sit 12th. Now they've got to go to first place Scunthorpe. And after, you know, this was the best opportunity that they've had in a good while to get a home win on the board against a team with the worst away performances so far this season. They haven't done that. They've done completely the opposite. They've got a loss, and now they've got to go to the first place team.
Well, Scunthorpe are absolutely tearing up. They're scoring more than 2 goals a game at the moment. They're absolutely just blitzing everyone.
You don't need that, especially when you're a team as currently inconsistent as MK Dons are. And, you know, I'm not going to read them all out to you like I've done before, but you only have to jump on the official website, and the story is there. They read like a team that's going down. I mean, MK Dons at the moment are not going down, and they're very unlikely to go down. But the stories there in regards to their home form are like, we're trying to stay positive. Are, you know, the team really keeping together? You know, we'll turn this around. That kind of quote. And it just feels like, you know, Jesus, like that's the mentality.
No, you're only 3 points off the rally spots, mate.
Yeah, but equally, I don't think they're that far off the playoff spots. So,
three points off the playoff spots. So.
Such is the nature of the league. But which is to say, again, as we've mentioned before, the season's far from over. There's still so much moving and shaking. Just look at Bolton. Bolton have gone on a terrible run of results. They're still in playoff places, and they've just picked up their first win in a few games. But, you know, they were cruising at top spot for a while. It's very chop and change. It can change very quickly. But they need to make it change.
In the lower leagues, you just need a run of like 5 or 6 good games, you know, where you win four of them or something, and you're absolutely flying at the league.
Yeah, absolutely. But they need to make a change, and so far, no good. Certainly not at home. But there you go. Enough depressing talk from me. We're gonna do something a little bit different now, Chris. Are you gonna come with me on this journey?
Always, of course.
Yeah. Well, I'd hoped you would. So what we thought we'd do is, given that it's an international break, and we don't want to cover every international team's performances, certainly not.
Also, because Andy and Matt aren't here, so
Andy and Matt decided to bugger off for another week. So what we thought we'd do is we'd spend the 15 minutes or so just going through the new FIFA and Pro Evo games. You know, we've made no secret of the fact that we're both fans of the electronic football, and certainly Football Manager. Esports? No. But we certainly put in our hours on FIFA and Pro Evo in the past. We've played both franchises quite a lot. Certainly you've had a lot of experience with Football Manager, as is Matt. I just thought it was worth running through the new releases, FIFA 17, Pro Evo 17, just to see what your initial impressions were and where you think you're going with them.
Well, I'll give you two statements.
Go.
This is going to be three. So I bought FIFA 17.
Yep.
After doing a little bit of research. I've since ordered Pro Evolution Soccer.
Yeah.
So that tells you one thing. And kind of FIFA, when I play offline and I play on my own because I'm, you know, I don't really like being told I'm a faggot and things online.
You've got us
and,
for that.
And the offline AI plays a bit like England played tonight.
Go for it.
So I'll have the ball and there'll be no moving up front. Players run up and down. They make the same fucking runs they did in the last game. The same AI as the last game. Very little overhaul. I haven't tried the Alex Hunter, I can't remember what it's called, but that mode thing, which I probably will get around to at some stage.
Yeah,
but it's not my main way of playing it. And for me, like if you found faults with FIFA 16 or you kind of got frustrated about it and you play offline and you were excited about, you know, a bit of an overhaul of the match engine and stuff, like, don't buy this game. That is the best advice I can give you. In particular, the career mode hasn't been touched. They've done a lot on like the lighting effects. Set pieces are a little bit better. That is really it. That is as
well.
Good
you
as
say
it gets.
That. I mean, you know, set pieces generally are a little bit better. And obviously, with I'm talking FIFA here. Set pieces are generally a little bit better. But penalties certainly are not a little bit better. They're far, far worse. And they should have left well alone when it came to that system, or at least came up with a better one.
I mean, the only other positive thing I can say is crosses work a bit better as well. That's
yeah.
it. But like the build up play, like it feels like you're playing a FIFA 16 game, which I thought was kind of, I kept going at it and I kept playing it until the bitter end. I know you dipped out very early because you got really pissed off with it. So
FIFA 16 was the game was, I mean, I should sort of to make my sort of full disclosure here, I used to do a few reviews on FIFA and Pro Evo games for what now is Xbox Magazine, official Xbox Magazine. And I was a big Pro Evo fan, I think as many people were, coming out of PlayStation 2, going into Xbox. And then FIFA, EA generally upped their game and I made the migration, as did many.
Yeah, around kind of FIFA 10 was kind of the turnover point, and certainly 12 and 13 and 14 were pretty good editions of FIFA.
Yeah, 16 was the one I bounced off hardest. I barely played any of last year's game because I got so frustrated with it. Certainly something you've already drawn your attention to, which was crossing. I, you know, whipping balls in the box was just nonsensical in the last game because the keeper would pick it every time. He'd just come out and pick it out of the air and... there was no point, you know, going out and buying a big, strong striker because it was massively a waste of time putting any cross in the box. They would always get picked off. You'd score one header in 15 games, which is entirely unrealistic. I got really annoyed with that. I got really annoyed with also some of the kind of mechanics in midfield. I felt like play was a bit ponderous, a bit soupy, and I don't think that's necessarily been fixed in the new
game. Also very similar. It didn't matter whether you were playing Barcelona or, you know, Barnet. They would kind of play the same way, play the same football. Like, no teams ever really pressed you very high. They all kind of sat off, and then they had quite a slow build-up when they were playing, and it was just...
Yeah,
It didn't matter anything about the game. It didn't matter. Like, every game played out the same.
Yeah, and to be fair, that's been a lot of... FIFA's problem for a long while is that they do get football. It's not like sort of 10 years ago where you could say they just don't get football, but Pro Evo and Konami have always got football better. They've always understood the mechanics of football better, that what makes football football and the individuality of each game. And you know, you could have argued for the last 2 or 3 years certainly that Pro Evo on the field has been a better game, but there wasn't enough around it to say, well, you should make the migration. That's an argument of subjective compellingness,
taste,
I guess.
Yeah. I think for me, the main thing about Pez, and I've been talking to a few people who play it, and I actually went and tested it out for a couple of games, but I was playing with someone else, so I wasn't really playing, or playing against someone else, so I wasn't really playing against the AI. But it kind of feels different. So if you're playing like a German, you know, gegenpressing team, it will feel like you're being rushed and harried. Whereas if you're playing like a team with a more, you know, thoughtful, slow-paced build-up, and you can't just, if you're not one of the best teams in the league, which I never play as, I'm not interested in playing as, you know, an Arsenal or anyone like that, you have to kind of adapt your tactics to overcome like the weaknesses in other teams rather than just
which is very real football, isn't it? It's much more of a simulation in that sense. One thing, like obviously you alluded to some of the changes in FIFA. We should give it its due. Like the mode you're talking about, the journey, that's been received incredibly well. I think it's quite good. I've only done a few games on it so far, but I know people certainly in and around the industry and certainly just friends who have been playing that too and really, really enjoy it. Surprised by how good it is.
But isn't the actual, I know that it's more than just playing football matches.
Mm.
And obviously there are scenarios that are invented where they say, you've got to come on and we're losing. And if you score the winner, you'll like, I don't know. I assume that's kind of how it works, not having played it. But surely the way the actual gameplay unfolds on the pitch is the same. There's nothing new there. So really what it's adding, and I'm not trying to undersell this, but really what it's adding is like a sense of kind of theatre and progression and, you know, that kind of stuff off.
Yeah, there is definitely that. And you could argue that that's been what's been missing from sort of the career mode for a very long while. I mean, there are some very subtle changes to career mode with some different objectives coming in terms of financial, in terms of youth team and stuff like that. Commercial, I think about shirt sales and, you know, buying marquee signings and stuff like that. So there are the sort of little objectives they've added, but they do feel like tick boxes compared to the things that have, you know, the sweeping changes that they could have made to that series, certainly that career mode for, and should have made a long while ago, that's not really been touched for a long while at the expense of things like Ultimate Team, which obviously is a huge money maker for them and people love. I don't spend a lot of time in because it's a huge amount of admin, but I know people absolutely love it. And certainly, I mean, one thing I'd advise everybody to do, and he makes points that we've kind of echoed here, so we should credit where it's due, but is to read Ben Wilson's two reviews on Games Radar. I think they're a really good sum up of both franchises, FIFA and PES. And Ben Wilson's former editor of Official PlayStation magazine. He does a solid job on these, and he gives both the review and the credit they deserve. One thing I will say about PES is, we kind of, I think we feel the same on this, is the kind of presentation and stuff off of the field. It's always been second best on that, constantly, since year dot. And do you feel like there's enough around it that, you know, now that the stuff on the field's so good, do you think that it balances out enough? Do you think there's enough there to bring people back?
So I've ordered PES because, yeah, like, I thought I'd just give them a good thorough test drive and decide which one I want to play, if this is going to be my defective year. I did play it a little bit at the weekend, like tested it out, and the menus were pretty horrific. Atrocious. Like, it's very slow.
Still got the busiest kind of Japanese music.
Yeah, but it feels like a really bad game interface from 10 years ago. I'm not lying. Like, it's really bad, like the way the menus are presented, and it's like you know, they just have, like, you can set up your own buttons, like, the way you want, you know, what you want different buttons to do, which kind of appeals to me because I play the old style of PES where, you know, certain buttons mean certain things. But they're just called, like, data set 1, data set 2, data set 3, data set 4. And it's like no one's even put any effort into thinking about, like, how they work, or calling it, like, PES 1 Classic or something like that. So minor things, but I think as you've mentioned when we've talked about this before, you probably do spend more than half your time, or about half your time, on the pitch and half your time off it. So if it's so
if
tedious,
you're, if you're invested in a career mode, or something like that, definitely,
So I think you know that there is the potential that will grate on me, and I'll buy both and end up playing neither. What an expensive mistake!
Yeah, I mean, worthy of saying, that is a huge gripe of mine, because, and I made this point in a review a couple of years ago. I think it was even like PES 14 or something like that, when they first brought in the Fox engine. If you're going to spend so much time and energy bringing in a brand new engine for your marquee sports game, which, you know, is one of their bigger sellers, Konami, it's a case of, why didn't you take the extra comparatively cheap and quick option of sorting out your disgraceful Windows 95 menus, which are just absolutely horrible. They're terrible to use. Like the way that the way that the team sits on the pitch when you're going in the tactics menu, it doesn't feel intuitive. It feels like, you know, it feels cumbersome even. And you just think, come on, these are the basic bits. These are the bits that are probably easy to get right compared to actually making football work on the pitch, which they do beautifully. And it's not all about licenses, which obviously EA has the massive one up on in terms of the money they can spend and the badges and everything they can use. But, and you know, they've spent a lot of money on their new Frostbite engine, and the game looks fantastic now, and certainly looks as good as it's done in a long while, FIFA. But it's not all about that, but it is about making the effort for some presentation. If you can't afford that, at least give me a menu I can look at without straining my eyes.
I hope what's going to happen is that I'll have to spend maybe, you know, my first couple of play sessions, like my first 2 hours or 3 hours or something, like just sort of sorting shit out and like getting my configuration right, and then that will make other stuff a lot quicker, which is a massive faff, but I kind of what I hope is going to be massive leap forward in terms of how the game actually plays. I hope that's going to be enough to offset it, but I haven't really played it yet. I'll report back perhaps if the other two sod off again and let us talk about this kind of stuff. I'll report
well
back.
I think we should definitely
weeks.
Like, you know, we're a football podcast, but you know, we'd be stupid to ignore the fact that a huge amount of football fans play massive amount of game time in these two franchises, and the other one, Football Manager, which is obviously something you and Matt and Andy have been invested in the past. Far less so me, because I'm dumb and I'm scared of spreadsheets. So I'll try and get back into it one day. Champ Manager 2, I think, was the last one that I really got into. So before it was even
Classic.
Football Manager. Yeah, back in the day with my Blackburn team. But yeah, we'll revisit this as we go on, because I think this is going to be interesting in terms of longevity, and obviously where we've got a bit more time on the podcast to talk about that, and maybe FM 2017 when that comes out as well.
Yeah, we're not going to turn into a gaming podcast, but where the two worlds collide, as you say, I think we can put in a 5 or 10 minute slot here or there.
Also, speaking of which, while we're on the collision course, there was a lovely there's a lovely thing going doing the rounds on Facebook, and I think on Reddit and YouTube. Gregory Coupe, who was one of the best FM signings back in the day, and his double save against Barcelona for Lyon. Which was something like 15 years to the day today. Well worth checking out that double save.
I haven't seen that. You have to.
Yeah,
have
and
to
reliving that moment, because that. Ah, what a man. What a man. Anyway, time to wrap up. Thanks again for joining us for the Libero podcast. Do check us out on Facebook. That's www.facebook.com/Libero podcast. And do drop us an email on there or a message on there, which we'll try and get back to you on. And we won't flood your terrible timeline with terrible, terrible stuff. We'll just point you towards articles that we think are cool and remind you when the next podcast's out. So give us a follow and shout us a message. I think we're done. I think it's full time. Say goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye. Hopefully we'll have a bit of a fuller house next week.
Yeah, man. And we'll see you next week for another Libero podcast. Take care.
I hear the sound of distant drums.